I want to speak on a topic today that's near and dear to my heart. I want to talk to you about non-intervention foreign policy. And it probably sounds like a strange topic and a boring one to many of you, but I think you'll find it interesting, I hope. Anyway, if you don't, I will. So it'll be good for me anyway. As many of you know, we've discarded and forgotten the biblical position of non-intervention and non-aggression, which this nation was founded upon. When our founders founded this nation, it was founded on the principle that we stayed out of the affairs of other nations and we didn't go to wars with other nations that hadn't attacked us. And we've left that largely, especially in the last 100 years and even before that, really. Proponents of the interventionist and imperialist foreign policy will cite Old Testament examples where God commanded Israel to utterly destroy the wicked nations and possess them as a justification for this position. So they will point back to Israel and they will say, well, Israel did it. You know, Israel was given commandment to go and just mop up other nations and destroy them completely. And therefore, since the United States is the new Israel, right, as many of them think, that God has likewise given us this mandate that we are to go out there and be the policemen of the world and right all of the wrongs in the earth and spread freedom and democracy to all the poor benighted peoples of the earth and help everybody out by bombing their lands and murdering hundreds of thousands of them. That's what we're supposed to do. So they'll use verses like Joshua, for instance. If you turn to Joshua 6, we're going to look at verse 17 and 20 and 21. And this was a commandment given to Joshua and the Israelites when they went into the city of Jericho, and they were supposed to completely and utterly destroy it. But this was a commandment from God. God told them to do this. And I'll get into that in just a little bit. So Joshua 6, in verse 17, says, "And the city shall be accursed, even it and all that are therein, to the Lord. Only Rahab the harlot shall live, she and all that are with her in the house, because she hath hid the messengers that we sent." In verse 20 and 21, says, "So the people shouted when the priests blew the trumpets, and it came to pass when the people heard the sound of the trumpet, and the people shouted with a great shout, that the wall fell down flat, so that the people went up into the city, every man straight before him, and they took the city, and they utterly destroyed all that was in the city, both man and woman, young and old, and ox and sheep and ass, with the edge of the sword." So they killed everybody. Men, women, children, animals. And this was at the commandment of God. There was another place in history in 1 Samuel 15, 2 through 3, when the Lord told Saul to destroy all the Amalekites. And I've actually had people debating this issue with him. Take me two passages like these are ones like them, and cite them and say, this is a mandate for a godly nation such as ourselves to rid the world of evil. Look in 1 Samuel 15, 2 through 3. It says, "Thus saith the Lord of hosts, I remember that which Amalek did to Israel, how he laid wait for him in the way when we came up from Egypt. Now go and smite Amalek and utterly destroy all that they have and spare them not, but slay both man and woman, infant and suckling, ox and sheep, camel and ass." So once again, men, women, children, all the animals, everything was supposed to be completely destroyed. Now, proponents of this position will say, well, yes, and God is the same. Jesus Christ the same yesterday, today, and forever. Malachi 3:6 says, "I am the Lord, I change not, therefore you sons of Jacob are not consumed." God's always the same, right? He doesn't change. And so if he commanded his nation back then to go up and mop up on other nations, then we likewise have the same mandate. And they'll say, you know, therefore that's why the USA should have this foreign policy that we have. Well, they are right. God has not changed, but they are missing a key fact. Though he doesn't change, his law has changed. We're under the New Testament. That's on the right side of the book. The Old Testament, we're no longer under. We can learn things from the Old Testament. The things that were written aforetime were written for our learning, that we through patient comforts of the Scriptures might have hope. We can learn from them, but we are not under mandates such as those that I just read. I'll just give you one verse for that in Hebrews 8 and verse 13, just to show you that we're no longer under the Old Testament. That Old Testament was nailed to the cross whenever Christ died, and he instituted a New Testament in his blood. Hebrews 8 and verse 13, says, in that he saith a new covenant, he hath made the first old. Now that which decayeth and waxeth old is ready to vanish away. As this book was being written, it was ready to vanish away. There was a little transitional period there from the time when Christ was crucified and resurrected until 70 AD. And once that transition period was over, it had fully passed away. And you can read in 2 Corinthians 3, where it says that it is done away, it's abolished, and so on. Now Jesus showed us that these Old Testament precedents like these have no natural application in the New Testament. I'm not saying they don't have an application in the New Testament. I'm not saying that we can't learn from these things, but they have no natural application. And I'll just give you one example of that. Turn to Luke chapter 9, 51 through 53. If you notice, New Testament to Old Testament, there's a bit of a change in how God relates with men and how God tells men to relate to men. There's quite a difference there. Look at Luke 9, 50 through 56. It says, and it came to pass when the time was come that he should be received up, he steadfastly set his face to go to Jerusalem and sent messengers before his face, and they went and entered into a village of the Samaritans to make ready for him. And they did not receive him because his face was as though he would go to Jerusalem. And when the disciples, James and John, saw this, they said, Lord, wilt thou that we command fire to come down from heaven and consume them, even as Elias did? Well, they looked back in the Old Testament, and they saw an Old Testament example of how God's prophet related to men back then. He brought fire down from heaven and destroyed, I don't know, was it 50 people about three times or so? Well, they are reading back into that and saying, Lord, should we do the same thing? Should we do as Elias? Let's see what Jesus says. But he turned and rebuked them and said, you know not what manner of spirit ye're of. For the Son of Man is not come to destroy men's lives, but to save them. And they went to another village. Yes, Jesus came not to destroy men's lives, but to save them, if you're reading a King James Bible. If you're not, apparently he didn't, because that verse is missing in the NIV and the other modern versions. Now, God's Israel under the New Testament is the church. It's not the USA, it's not the United Kingdom or British Israelism or anything like that. It's not even the modern-day nation of Israel. Israel in the New Testament is not even that plot of ground over there on the eastern side of the Mediterranean. That's not Israel. The New Testament church is Israel. Therefore, the USA is not some new Israel and doesn't have a manifest destiny to conquer other nations and create an imperial empire. This is what a lot of the first settlers thought when they came to take over all the Indian land, that we had some manifest destiny, that we were supposed to come over here and wipe out these heathen just like Israel did when they went into the land of Canaan. Show me book, chapter, and verse for that in the New Testament. Show it to me. I don't see it. Since we are now under the New Testament, where does the New Testament give any country a commandment from God to start aggressive wars with its neighbor? Not just the USA, any country. Where does a country have a mandate from God in the New Testament to start aggressive wars with its neighbor when it has not been attacked? Show it to me. Show it to me and I'll change my opinion. For example, what if our government wanted to wage a war on Mexico? And they said, you know, those people down there, they're a bunch of drug-running heathens, they're a bunch of Catholic savages, and they just deserve to be wiped off the face of the earth. They're nothing but a menace to us. They create all this crime coming across the border. Therefore, we need to do some ethnic cleansing and go down there and just wipe them all out. Would anybody think that that's a good idea? I wouldn't think it's a good idea. Where would you, and then maybe they'll use the principles that God gave to Israel in the Old Testament. Well, that's what he told them to do. But shouldn't we do it? I mean, they're corrupting our country, right? Show me the New Testament example for that, or precept, or commandment. What justification could a neocon Christian give from the New Testament to wage such a war of aggression? And the New Testament counterpart to these Old Testament commandments would be for Christians to mortify or to kill the sins of their flesh and to not spare any of them. You remember the Amalekites, men, women, children, sucklings, all of them. Yeah, God wants sin wiped out completely. Well, in the New Testament, spiritually, we should mortify all of our sins, even the little ones. The big ones and the little ones. Turn to Colossians 3, 5 through 9. I'm all for waging wars of aggression. If you want to wage it on yourself and your own sin, go ahead. But please don't do it in my name overseas. Colossians 3, 5 through 9. It says, mortify, that means to kill. Mortify, therefore, your members, which are upon the earth, fornication, uncleanness, inordinate affection, evil concupiscence, and covetousness, which is idolatry. For which things sake the wrath of God cometh on the children of disobedience, in the which ye also walked some time when ye lived in them. But now ye also put off all these, anger, wrath, malice, blasphemy, filthy communication out of your mouth. Lie not one to another, seeing that ye have put off the old man with his deeds, and have put on the new man, which is renewed in knowledge after the image of him that created him. That's the wars that we ought to be waging. We ought to be waging a war on our own sin, mortifying our own sinful members. The weapons of our, that is the church's, spiritual Israel's warfare, are not carnal, but spiritual. The weapons that we use are not F-16s, they're not bombers, they're not tanks, they're not any of these kind of things. They're spiritual weapons. That's what the church uses. There are other churches out there that use carnal weapons over the years. They've murdered millions with the literal sword, but that's not what our mandate is. Look at 2 Corinthians 10, 3 through 5. 2 Corinthians 10, 3 through 5. I'm not a pacifist, by the way. I'll get into that. Non-interventionism is not pacifism. It's not isolationism. I'll cover that too. 2 Corinthians 10, 3 through 5. It says, for though we walk in the flesh, we do not war after the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty through God to the pulling down of strongholds, casting down imaginations and every high thing that exalteth itself against the knowledge of God, and bringing into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ. You see, we cast down imaginations, not walls. We bring thoughts into captivity, not nations. We mortify our own sins, not dictators or authoritarians. Now, as I mentioned, non-interventionism is not pacifism. Let me give you a few definitions here. Non-intervention is absence of intervention in international politics, systematic non-interference by a nation in the affairs of other nations except where its own interests are directly involved. So basically, that's a bunch of words for saying you mind your own business, you don't get involved in other nations' problems that aren't yours, that don't directly affect you. If another nation cuts off all trade supplies to you or something, well, then you've been affected, and maybe that would be a time that if diplomacy fails, then maybe war would be the only means to do that. Or, of course, if a foreign country invades our country and there's troops on this soil, yeah, that'd be a good time to go to war. That would be a good time to go to war. But prior to that, if other nations are just doing their own thing and voting in people that we don't like, that's not a time to go to war. Pacifism is the policy or doctrine of rejecting war and every form of violent action as a means of solving disputes, especially in international affairs. The belief in and advocacy of peaceful methods as feasible and desirable alternatives to war. Now, I don't really have a problem with that definition, and up to a point, I would totally agree. I mean, I would call myself a pacifist by that definition, but they would take it to the point where you never would fight. You know, you would, no matter what. I mean, if somebody invades your country, you just kind of say, you know, well, come on in, and we won't resist. And that's not a biblical position, as I will show you. The Bible doesn't condemn soldiering or war in all circumstances. Let me give you some examples of that. When soldiers came to John the Baptist to be baptized, he told them to be just, honest, and content, but he didn't tell them to forsake their profession as soldiers. He didn't say, well, if you want to be baptized, you're going to have to stop being a soldier because that is a sin. He didn't say that. Look in Luke 3 and verse 14. I just think this topic is so important because conservatives will get up there and they will decry abortion, how we murder 1.5 million people, babies, every year. And the same people are just fine with sending our boys overseas and murdering hundreds of thousands of people, many of which are children. In the 90s, we put sanctions on Iraq. And Madeleine Albright said, when asked about it, when 500,000 children were killed because of our sanctions, she said it was, quote, worth it. Yeah. Is it worth it to murder 500,000 children because we don't like some dictator over there? I mean, how is that? You know, it's like if it's war, it's just, well, war is hell and war is this and war is that. And all of a sudden, what would be murder in any other context all of a sudden is just okay. How does that happen? Look at Luke 3:14. This is why I'm so passionate about this. Luke 3:14, and the soldiers likewise demanded of him, saying, "And what shall we do?" And he said unto them, "Do violence to no man, neither accuse any falsely, and be content with your wages." Notice he didn't say, "Well, you better take that uniform off, put that gun away, or that put that sword away." He didn't tell them that, but he told them that they had to be just and honest and not do violence. Obviously, if you're in war and combat, you're doing violence. That's not what he's speaking of there. He's talking about unjust violence when you beat people up or steal their stuff just because you're a soldier and you can. And lest anybody think that I'm some kind of a pinko commie, I think most of you know I served in the military. I was overseas in Iraq. I know all about it. So, you know, don't try to throw vegetables at me or something if you don't think that I know what I'm talking about. Ministers are referred to as soldiers. Look at Philippians 2 and verse 25. So God is not going to use terminology of soldiering to describe ministry if soldiering was sin, right? Look at Philippians 2 and verse 25. Some of these points you'd read over, you never even think of them to be used in this way, but it makes good sense. Philippians 2 and verse 25 says, "Yet I suppose it necessary to send to you Epaphroditus, my brother and companion in labor and fellow soldier, but your messenger, that he that ministered to my wants." So here's a guy that was called a fellow soldier. Ministers are also called fellow laborers. Ministers labor, and they also war. Ask Pastor Boffy what it's like. Sometimes you got to go to battle, right? Unfortunately, that's the unfun, to use an Orwellian term, an unfun part of the job. Look at 2 Timothy 2:3-4. Paul describes ministers as soldiers who are warring. 2 Timothy 2:3-4. Paul says, "Thou therefore endure hardness as a good soldier of Jesus Christ. No man that warreth entangleth himself with the affairs of this life, that he may please him who hath chosen him to be a soldier." So, if soldiering was sinful, my point is God would not use it to describe the ministry. He wouldn't say, "Thou therefore endure hardness as a good adulterer for Jesus Christ." Right? Adultery is sin. He's not gonna liken the ministry to something that's a sinful profession, or as a good prostitute for Jesus Christ. He's not gonna do that. So if soldiering was sinful, he certainly wouldn't say endure hardness as a good soldier. He would certainly pick another profession that was not sinful. That's my whole point. Soldiering is not sinful. That's what I'm trying to tell you. Now the Bible uses the principles of war making for illustrations. Jesus used this principle to illustrate the importance of counting the cost of discipleship. Look at Luke 14:31-33. This verse fits very well with the baptism service we just had. Whenever you commit to Christ, whenever you're baptized, you put your hand to that plow, you better count the cost first. It's a big decision. You don't want to make it lightly. Luke 14:31-33. Jesus said, "Or what king going to make war after another king sitteth not down first and consulteth whether he is able with 10,000 to meet him that cometh against him with 20,000? Or else while the other is yet a great way off, he sendeth an ambassage and desireth conditions of peace. So likewise, whosoever he be of you that forsaketh not all that he hath, he cannot be my disciple." So Jesus uses an example of a king going to war and says, this king better count the cost. I'm going to go against a kingdom that has twice as many soldiers as I have. That might not be a wise idea. Likewise, when you want to be Christ's disciple, you better count the cost and say, am I really serious about this? Am I willing to do what Christ said, to take his yoke upon me, to put my hand to that plow through thick and thin and not look back? Am I ready for this? That's what Jesus is teaching here, and that's what our little sister just did today. She put her hand to that plow. Paul uses the principle of war making to illustrate the fact that a minister ought to be paid for his labor. Here's another one for you. Look in 1 Corinthians 9 and verse 7. just want to give a nice long disclaimer here that I am not against soldiering in all circumstances. 1 Corinthians 9 and verse 7. Paul says here he is addressing ministers working and being paid for their labor in the ministry and sometimes working outside the ministry as well. And he's trying to prove a point here that ministers ought to be paid for their labor and they ought to live off of the gospel. A pastor shouldn't have to work a second job. Sometimes it's necessary, but that's not how it should be. It says, who goeth a warfare any time at his own charges? Who planteth the vineyard and eateth not the fruit thereof? Or who feedeth a flock and eateth not of the milk of the flock? So it'd be ridiculous to say that a soldier would go over there and fight on his own dime, pay his own way, his own plane ticket, his own uniforms, his own ammo and everything else. Paul's saying the same thing there. A soldier wouldn't go to war at his own charges. Why would a minister minister at his own charges? That's not the way it's supposed to work. But my point is, Paul once again uses an example of warfare to prove a principle in the ministry. Now, the Bible allows for and it promotes self-defense. Let me cover this for just a few minutes. The thing is, though, most wars are not in self-defense. They're rather the product of the lust of men for power or control or resources. Name me a war in the last 200 years that was in self-defense. Okay, maybe World War II. Maybe. Although we went over there and fought with Germany, who never attacked us. And does it really make sense to go to war with a country and lose hundreds of thousands of lives because they killed a few thousand of us? I don't know. Just a question. But anyway, maybe. And I think it's pretty well the consensus that we knew we were going to be attacked by Japan anyway. And we provoked the attack by cutting off all of their supplies. So there's maybe one war in the last, who knows, over 100 years that has been a war of self-defense. And all the rest of them were based on lies. All right, so anyway, look at James 4, 1 through 2. James 4, 1 through 2. Now, James is speaking here of individuals in a church, but the principles still hold true. It says, from whence come wars and fightings among you? I could ask the same thing to our government. Whence come wars and fightings among you and other nations? Come they not hence, even of your lusts that war in your members? Exactly, that's where they come from. Lust, lust of power, lust of hegemony, lust of resources. Ye lust and have not, ye kill and desire to have and cannot obtain. Ye fight and war, yet ye have not, because ye ask not. Jesus commanded his disciples to be armed with a sword and even to sell their garments and buy one if they didn't have one. The Bible is not against self-defense. Look at Luke 22 and verse 36. As is with most topics, you need to steer between two extremes, from neocon war-making at every turn on one side to absolute pacifism on the other side. There's somewhere in the middle where the truth is. Luke 22 and verse 36. This would be a good engraving to get put on your pistol. I think that'd be a neat idea. Yeah. Who would have thought? Luke 22:36, and they said unto him, then he said unto them, then said he unto them, there, third time's a charm, but now he that hath a purse, let him take it, and likewise his scrip, that's his bag, and he that hath no sword, let him sell his garment and buy one. So prior to this point, when Jesus sent the disciples out to go out and do their evangelism, he said, don't take anything with you. Just go find the first house that receives you. Go in and whatever they give you, take it. If they don't receive it, if they don't receive you, then wipe the dust off your feet and move on. But don't take anything with you. They didn't need to take provision and they didn't need to take defense. But now he tells them he's going to be ascended to heaven soon. And now he tells them, you get yourself a bag. You get yourself a sword, even if you have to sell your garment to buy one, get it. It's a dangerous place out there. There's going to be thieves and robbers. Paul talks about perils of robbers. There's robbers on the way. I mean, Jesus is a realist. You know, we live in a sinful world. Jesus was not here talking about a spiritual sword. A lot of people try to explain this away. Oh, he's talking about the Bible. He's talking about a spiritual sword. You know that from his response when the disciples said that, you know, we found two swords. He says there in verse 38, and they said, Lord, behold, here are two swords. And he said unto them, I was talking about a spiritual sword, dummy. That's not what he said. He said, it is enough. It's enough. Two guns are enough. You got your primary and your backup. You got two guns on you. I mean, that's good. It's enough. Jesus said that a strong man armed keeps his house in peace. Look at Luke 11, verse 21. I'm not some fanatic up here saying you should carry three guns on yourself. I mean, no reason to be ridiculous. I mean, two is plenty. Luke 11 and verse 21. Jesus said, when a strong man, and look at that next word, armed, keepeth his palace, his goods are in peace. Yeah. How is he going to keep his goods in peace? He's armed. He's got weapons. He can protect himself. You just don't beg the thief to leave when he comes, right? You shoot him. That's what you're supposed to do. Jesus said that the goodman, or a goodman, which is a master or male head of a household, would not suffer, which means to tolerate or allow, his house to be broken up by a thief, or broken into, as we would say today. Look at Matthew 24 and verse 43. Matthew 24 and verse 43. Jesus is speaking of his second coming here and how it's going to come like a thief in the night. It's going to be a big surprise. Nobody's going to know it. Just the way that you don't know when a thief comes. You don't expect him, and all of a sudden, there the door gets kicked in or the window gets broken. It's a big surprise. Not secret, or not it's secret, not quiet, but it's just a surprise. And he says there in verse 43, but know this, that if the good men of the house had known in what watch the thief would come, he would have watched and would not have suffered his house to be broken up. Well, how is he not going to suffer his house to be broken up? Well, he's going to protect his house. He's going to be armed. He's not going to allow that thief to break into his house. You can compare that with Exodus 22 and verse 2. Back in the law, if somebody broke into your house, especially if it was at night, and you killed the man, there was no punishment for that. And I totally agree. Somebody breaks into your house at night, they deserve to die. I have no problem with that whatsoever. Exodus 22 and verse 2 says, if a thief be found breaking up and be smitten that he die, there shall no blood be shed for him. If the sun be risen upon him, and there shall be blood shed for him, for he should make full restitution. If he have nothing, then he shall be sold for his theft. So if it's daylight out, then there was a provision there that you know, if it's daylight and you can see the man, and then you know whether he's trying to kill you and harm you or not, then that was a little bit different. But yeah, if it was at night, there would be no punishment for that. Okay, so non-interventionism is not isolationism either. This is a common charge to those of us who are familiar with this and talk to people about it. So, oh, you're an isolationist. You just think that we should just close down our borders and not ever just bury our heads in the sand like an ostrich. That's not what I'm saying. Isolationism is, according to the Oxford English Dictionary, the policy of seeking political or national isolation with special reference to the USA. So let's define some terms here. It says it's seeking isolation. Isolation is the action of isolating, the fact or condition of being isolated or standing alone, separation from other things or persons, solitariness. And to isolate, the verb, is to place or set apart or alone, to cause to stand alone, detached, separate, or unconnected with other things or persons, to insulate. So to be an isolated nation, or to have an isolation policy, would be to not do any business with any other nations, to not trade with them, to not vacation with them, to not allow visitors or anything like that, just to say we're going to be an island and we're going to have nothing to do with anybody else. That's not non-intervention. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is what Thomas Jefferson said in his first inaugural address in 1801. He said, peace, commerce, and honest friendship with all nations, entangling alliances with none. Let's have peace, let's have commerce, let's trade with people, let's be friends as best we can, but no entangling alliances. Entangling alliances cause wars. That's supposedly, anyway, how World War I was started. I don't know if that's really how it happened. That's what the history books tell us anyway. You get a bunch of nations saying, hey, if they attack you, I'll jump in. And then, oh, if they attack you, I'll jump in. before you know it, you got 50 different nations. Everybody's going to jump in, and then one little thing happens, and everybody jumps in, and it's a world war. Not a good idea. That's why I don't think we should be involved in NATO or any of these other organizations, which are nothing more than war-making organizations. Now, this next point is very, very important. International, and I put a little hyphen there just to emphasize, international conduct should, or at least sometimes, be governed by the same principles in the New Testament as interpersonal conduct. Let me prove my point first, and then once I prove this point, then I can go and I can show you lots of biblical principles of non-intervention in the Scripture. Now, biblical laws regulating the action of a government towards its citizens are not always necessarily the same as the laws regulating actions between individuals. So somebody might try to interpret the Bible in such a way that you just go anywhere in the Bible and you find any law and just say, well, that law applies to everybody, regardless. And that's not a, that's a terrible way, method of Bible interpretation, because there are certain laws that are only for certain people or classes or groups or whatever. For instance, I mean, you have laws that tell governments how to relate to their people and tell people to submit to their governments, right? But those laws wouldn't apply to me and a friend of mine, right? I don't have to submit to him. He doesn't have the power of the sword over me and so on. So you have to be careful how you interpret Scripture, but follow me here. I think you'll see it. Like I said, the government is an authority over its citizenry, so that's a different relationship than citizens to citizens. This is distinctly different from the relationship I just said that of two individuals have with each other. The civil authority has the power of the sword to execute vengeance on them that do evil. Let me just give you one example of how the government is under a different set of rules than we are by the law of God anyway. They're not above the law like they think they are, but there are different things that apply to them. Look at Romans 13 and verses 1 through 4. It says, let every soul be subject unto the higher powers, for there is no power but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God. It's interesting, all the phrases in the King James Bible that come into our modern language, you've all heard the phrase, the powers that be, comes right out of there. There's so many of those things in the King James Bible. Whosoever therefore resisteth the power resisteth the ordinance of God, and they that resist shall receive to themselves damnation. For rulers are not a terror to good works, but to the evil. Wilt thou then not be afraid of the power? Do that which is good, and thou shalt have praise of the same, for he is the minister of God to thee for good. But if thou do that which is evil, be afraid, for he beareth not the sword in vain, for he is the minister of God, a revenger to execute wrath upon him that doeth evil. That's what the government is supposed to be there for. They're supposed to punish evil and promote good. When you have a government that punishes good and lets people get away with evil, they're not following the precepts of this. And at some point, we ought to obey God rather than men. But that's another topic for another time. But anyway, you see here, these verses are not speaking individual to individual. This is an individual's relationship with the government. There are verses in here that tells you to submit to your pastor, and he's got the rule over you. But that's not talking about church member to church member. I mean, there's different, you know. Granted, we have verses that tell us to submit to one another, too, but different verses for different peoples and situations. But an individual, he doesn't have the right. He doesn't have the power to avenge himself when he's wrong. You know, the government can. The government can act really in self-defense of people that it represents. So if somebody kills you, then the government can investigate it. And if they find the person guilty, then they can execute the vengeance. God gives them that power. They can do that. So in a sense, they are doing your self-defense for you. You don't need to take it into your own hands, nor should you, unless it's an immediate threat. Somebody points a gun at you, you don't wait for the police officers to put them on trial. Look at Romans 12, 17 through 19. It said, recompense to no man evil for evil, provide things honest in the sight of all men, if it be possible. As much as lieth in you, live peaceably with all men. Dearly beloved, avenge not yourselves, but rather give place unto wrath, for it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord. So yeah, you give that to God. Unless it's a direct situation, somebody's trying to cut your head off or something, well then yeah, you can defend yourself. But when you're wronged, you don't go back and execute vengeance and wrath on somebody else after the fact. Let the law of God take care of them. Let the law of the land take care of them. We don't have that same power of the sword as the government does. Now, in the case of international conduct, the nations are peers one of each other. They're not authorities and subordinates. So if we look at the United States in our dealings with Ukraine or whoever, anybody for that matter, we are not an authority over them. They're not an authority over us. We're peers. Like, you know, we're like two citizens relating to each other as opposed to a citizen relating to his government. We are not the government of the world, and so nations would be peers. Nations are comprised of individuals. They relate to each other as individuals. Let me show you. Nations are even referred to as individuals, such as the nations of Israel and Edom, which were referred to by their founding, or as their founding fathers. Look at Genesis 25 and verse 23. This is when God was telling Abraham and Sarah that they would have twin boys, Jacob and Esau. No, this is telling Isaac and Rebekah that they were going to have twin boys, Jacob and Esau. Got the generational gap there. Pardon me, he ordained me, so blame it on him. All right.
That gap or that line.
All right, Genesis 25 and verse 23. And the Lord said unto her, two nations are in thy womb, and two manner of people shall be separated from thy bowels, and the one people shall be stronger than the other people, and the elder shall serve the younger. So he's referring to two babies in the womb, Jacob and Esau, but he's calling them nations. So here we have people, individuals referred to as nations. Let's look at it the other way, where nations are referred to as individuals. Look in Numbers 20, 17 through 22. Numbers 20, 17 through 22. This is when Israel was going through the wilderness, and they were heading to the promised land, and Israel asked Edom if they could pass through their land rather than going around, and they said, hey, you know, we won't take anything, we're just going to pass right through, we'll even pay you if we take any water or anything from you. So look at, let's start in verse 17. Actually, let's start in verse 14. And Moses sent messengers from Kadesh unto the king of Edom. Who knows who Edom was? Anybody remember? Edom? Edom is Esau. All right, very good. Just another name for Esau. So he sent messengers to the king of Esau. Thus saith thy brother Israel, thou knowest all the travail that hath befallen us, how our fathers went down into Egypt, and we have dwelt in Egypt a long time, and the Egyptians vexed us and our fathers. And when we cried unto the Lord, he heard our voice, and sent an angel, and hath brought us forth out of Egypt. And behold, we are in Kadesh, a city in the uttermost of thy border. Let us pass, I pray thee. Notice the singular pronouns. I pray thee. That's singular. Through thy country. That's singular. We will... Now we, jumps back to plural, we will not pass through the fields nor through the vineyards, neither will we drink of the water of the well, of the wells. We will go by the king's highway. We will not turn to the right hand nor to the left until we have passed thy borders. And Edom said unto him, notice the personal pronouns, him, thou, that's another singular, thou shalt not pass by me, lest I come out against thee with the sword. You see how the nations are referred to individuals? Thou and thee, I, me. And the children of Israel said unto him, we will go by the highway, and if I or my cattle drink of thy water, then I will pay for it. I will only, without doing anything else, go through on my feet. And he said, thou shalt not go through. And Edom came out against him with much people and with a strong hand. Thus Edom refused to give Israel passage through his border. Therefore, Israel turned away from him. So you see there how these two nations are referred to multiple times as individuals. I, me, thee, thou. So you have nations, and they're even interacting as individuals. No different than if one individual would come to another person's property and say, hey, let me walk through your property here, and I won't take any food, and let me just go through. And he says, no. Well, these are nations interacting just as individuals interact with each other. Jesus used an example of how a nation would count the cost when deciding to go to war with another nation to illustrate how an individual should count the cost when deciding to follow him. And we looked at that verse already in Luke 14, 31 through 33. So once again, individual counting the cost are likened unto nations dealing with each other. Therefore, some of the same laws and principles in Scripture should apply to international conduct as applied to interpersonal conduct. So let's look at a few of those. Let's look at the principles of non-intervention. So these following points apply to individuals, and they also apply to nations as well. And I will even prove this to you based on what God said to Babylon. So it's one thing to make this correlation and say, nations are referred to as individuals, therefore the same laws that apply to individuals apply to nations. That would be a valid assumption, I think, but I can show you how God deals with a nation and specifically holds him to the same type of laws that I'm showing you right here, and even refers to him as a man, as an individual. The first one, mind your own business. That's the first rule of foreign policy. Mind your own business. Stay in your own lane, as we used to say back in the army. Don't meddle with strife not belonging to you. How many trillions of dollars and tens of thousands of lives have we lost not minding our own business? Not to mention the millions of other lives over the years. We don't really care about the brown people on the other side of the globe, you know, because they're over there and they're those bad people. But, you know, we lose a few soldiers as a travesty. We go over there and bomb a wedding party in Yemen with drones. Ah, collateral damage. Who cares, right? No big deal. We kill 200 and some children in the last 5 or 6 years with our drone strikes in Yemen and Pakistan. Ah, well, it's collateral damage. You know, we tried our best. I mean, you can't always tell. You know, sometimes you just have to kill innocent children. Our administration is not too worried about it. Look at Proverbs 26 and verse 17. What do you think we would do? What do you think we would do if China was flying drones over this country and bombing wedding parties accidentally, and they said, sorry, it's just collateral damage? Yeah. We're like, oh, okay, well, if it's just collateral, okay, yeah, so you had some bad intelligence. All right, no problem. Just please don't do it again. Yeah. What do you think we would do? How about do unto others as you'd have them to do unto you? That's going to be the next one. There's an idea. Look at Proverbs 26 and verse 17. It says, he that passeth by and meddleth with strife belonging not to him is like one that taketh a dog by the ears. How many times have we done that? Pass by, grab a dog by the ears. You ever grab a dog by the ears? Try it sometime. Go to a Rottweiler and grab him by both ears and see what happens. You're going to get bitten. He's going to bite you, right? Well, let me tell you, if you go overseas and you grab a dog by the ears, like another nation, you're going to get bitten. If there's going to be what you call blowback, it will happen. We're not supposed to be busybodies in other men's matters. Why are we over here fighting all these imperialistic wars with countries that we really have no national interest in, or we shouldn't? Oh, it's because we care about the poor. We care about the children over there. We care about the innocents. We need to spread freedom and democracy to them. And we heard this stupid thing, the war in Iraq. We need to spread freedom and democracy to them. So democracy, if I understand it correctly, works that when the majority of people vote for something, that's what the nation does. So here for years, the majority of the people in the United States didn't want us to be in Iraq. The majority of Iraqis didn't want us to be in Iraq. But yet we are overthrowing democracy to bring in democracy. The stupidest thing I could ever even conceive of. Look at 1 Peter 4 and verse 15.
Maybe it's not about democracy.
Yeah, maybe not. All you need to do is just drape a flag over it and sing God Bless America, and the sheep will just step right in line. That's all you have to do. That's what they use flags for, to cover your eyes and then to bring back the boys in the coffins, to cover the coffins. That's what they use them for. 1 Peter 4 and verse 15. I know, I blasphemeth, right? You're not supposed to say these kind of things. How could you dare speak against the greatest nation on earth? We're God's people, don't you know? We're God's nation. Yeah. I'm against the people. That's right, I'm a Jeremiah. Come visit me in prison someday. 1 Peter 4 and verse 15. Peter says, but let none of you suffer as a murderer, or as a thief, or as an evildoer, or as a busybody in other men's matters. Just put this in the context of national foreign policy. Why would murderer and thieves and evildoers be lumped in there with busybodies? Well, it makes perfect sense. Well, I mean, our busybodiness is so that we can murder and rob other nations of resources and put in our puppet governments over there. Sometimes it backfires, though, like in Ukraine right now. You know, we incited that whole thing. Victoria Nuland, the Assistant Secretary of State, they have her on tape, saying that we incited that whole rebellion over there and tried to get them to overthrow their democratically elected puppet that I think we put in there also. And now they get some other guy in there we don't like, and now we're trying to start up a Cold War again. People resent you when you get in the middle of their fights. You ever try to get in the middle of somebody's fight? Two guys are getting into a fight. You say, whoa, guys, hold on here. Let's work this thing out. Guess who's the next one that's going to get punched? You. You're going to get a black eye out of it. Look at Exodus 2:13-14. Try to jump between a husband and wife who are having a fight and help them reconcile together. See how that works out for you. They probably won't be fighting anymore because they'll be fighting against you. Exodus 2:13-14. This is Moses whenever he saw an Egyptian being mistreated by one of the slave handlers, and he killed the guy. And we're told in the New Testament that he did it in self-defense, defending the man's life. But anyway, he comes back then the next day, and he sees two of his brethren fighting, and he tries to separate them, to reconcile them, so they don't fight. They didn't take kindly to it. Look at verse 13-14. And when he went out the second time, behold, two men of the Hebrews strove together, and he said to him that did the wrong, wherefore smitest thou thy fellow? And he said, who made thee a prince and a judge over us? Intendest thou to kill me as thou killest the Egyptian? And Moses feared and said, surely this thing is known. They didn't like somebody getting in between them and trying to help them out. You wonder why America is hated abroad. How could they hate us? We're such a great nation. We're just such a godly people. And well, we send them cable TV over there, satellite TV, and they see the smut on our TV. That would be one reason they would hate us. The other one is we're dropping bombs on them. People generally don't like it when you drop bombs on them. We're doing it for your own good. Trust us. Trust us. You know, it's for your own good, really. Recent examples of this principle not being followed would be the wars in Libya or potential wars in Syria and Ukraine. All right, the next principle. Obey the golden rule. I mean, here's a wild idea. Luke 6:31, as ye would that men should do to you, do ye also to them likewise. We should treat others like we would want to be treated. You know, do we want to be bombed? Do we want to be invaded? Do we want people to come over here and export their version of government to us? No. So why would we do it to others? It's just really simple principles. This is not rocket science. Matthew 22:39 says, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. Treat others as you would want them to treat you. It's very simple. Don't murder people who have not attacked you. I mean, this is common sense. Any kid knows this. See, when kids grow up and their mothers and dads teach them, you know, you don't hit your brother for no reason. You don't steal his toys. Stealing is bad. Hitting is bad. Violence is bad. And then we go up and we get in the government schools and they say, well, as long as it's the government doing it to the citizenry or our government doing it to another one, well, stealing's okay. You know, I mean, we call it taxation. You know, robbery's okay. And killing's okay. We call that war. You know, murder's all right. It just depends who's doing it to who. Ron Paul got booed in South Carolina, the Bible Belt, so-called, for saying that we ought to adopt a golden rule in foreign policy. He's in the Bible Belt, allegedly in the front of a whole audience of probably Christians, probably Baptists for that matter, and he says we ought to adopt a golden rule in foreign policy. Treat other nations like we want them to treat us. Boo! Unbelievable. I'm not making it up. You can go YouTube it. I saw it. Unbelievable. Recent examples of this would be the war in Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia. I mean, you talk about a terrorist organization. The greatest terrorist organization is Washington, D.C. I mean, it sounds blasphemous, but it really is. We literally go over there and terrorize these nations. Can you imagine what it would be like to live in Yemen or Pakistan or some of those nations where we have this drone warfare going on? You don't see the drones. They're way up in the air. You're just walking along, and boom, huge explosion, and you're dead. I mean, you wouldn't even want to live. I wouldn't even want to leave my house if I was over there, especially if I lived in a certain village or something that had been targeted for those kind of things. When you talk about a terrorist, I mean, that is terrorism by definition. But it's not terrorism if we do it. Here's a recommendation for you. Stop saying we. Stop saying us. Start saying them. I'm not dropping bombs on people. So why would I say we are bombing Yemen? No, we are not. They are. When you talk about the government, talk about them, not we. They don't have my consent for this. Act only. Here's the next principle. Act only in self-defense. Don't initiate violence. We all learned this as a kid, right? You don't initiate violence. Proverbs 3:30 says, strive not with a man without cause, if he have done thee no harm. Somebody hasn't hurt you, don't fight with him. That's really simple, right? Okay, please, list off the things. What did Saddam Hussein do to hurt us? It's kind of quiet in here. I don't hear it. Come on, not everybody at the same time. Come on, let's hear him. Mobile biological weapons labs. Nuclear weapons. Yeah. Right. Yeah, he didn't do us any harm. Why in the world did we go over there, destroy his country? And he wasn't a good guy, granted, but it's a lot worse over there now than before we went. A lot worse. Peter had a right to self-defense whenever he defended Jesus. A right to self-defense. In Luke 22, we already read these verses, 36 through 38, Jesus told Peter and the other apostles, get yourself a sword. Obviously, a weapon that was the superior weapon of self-defense at that time. So Peter had the right to self-defense. But what Peter did was not self-defense. Jesus had told Peter that he would be killed by the Jewish leaders and even rebuked him for refusing to believe it. So Peter should have known that Jesus was going to be taken by the men and crucified, and he should not have acted to try to defend Jesus in that situation. Look at Matthew 16, 21 through 23. I'm just showing you the difference between legitimate self-defense and aggression. Matthew 16, 21 through 23. It said, from that time forth began Jesus to show unto his disciples how that he must go unto Jerusalem and suffer many things of the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed and be raised again the third day. Then Peter took him and began to rebuke him, saying, be it far from thee, Lord, this shall not be unto thee. But he turned and said unto him, or he said unto Peter, get thee behind me, Satan, thou art an offense unto me, for thou savorest not the things that be of God, but those that be of men. Poor old Peter there went from being blessed to possessed in a space of about 10 verses. He said, who do men say that I am? Who do you say that I am? He said, thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. He said, blessed art thou, Simon Bar-Jonah, for flesh and blood hath not revealed it unto thee, but my Father is in heaven. He blesses him there. Just a few verses later, he says, get thee behind me, Satan. He goes from being blessed to possessed in just a couple of minutes. Isn't that how it happens? Jesus had prayed for God's will to be done. Look in Matthew 26 and verse 42. Matthew 26 and verse 42. He went away again the second time and prayed, saying, O my Father, if this cup may not pass away from me, except I drink it, thy will be done. So Jesus was resolved that the Lord's will be done. So not only did Jesus tell him he was going to be crucified, then Jesus says, thy will be done. Peter should have known better. Peter therefore stepped over the line when he initiated violence. Look at John 18, 10 through 11. John 18, 10 through 11. Then Simon Peter, having a sword, drew it and smote the high priest's servant and cut off his right ear. The servant's name was Malchus. Then said Jesus unto Peter, put up thy sword into thy sheath. The cup which my Father hath given me, shall I not drink it? So Peter was rebuked for that. And Jesus even gives him a stronger rebuke in Matthew 26, 51 through 52. It's not that Peter used violence here, but it's that he used violence at a time when he shouldn't have. He had the right to defend himself. And think about this too, and I don't have this in the outline. I know I've mentioned this at another time. Jesus was an able-bodied man who could defend himself. It's one thing if one of Peter's kids were there and somebody comes to take him. Well, yeah, Peter would have definitely had the right to defend his child. But Jesus is an able-bodied adult man who could easily defend himself. Not only could he defend himself, he could call down 12 legions of angels to wipe all these guys out. So Peter didn't need to be trying to slice the guy's forehead in half. You know, he missed. He was aiming. I'm sure he was aiming for the forehead. You know, he just wasn't a good aim. He got the ear. That's my speculation, but look at Matthew 26:51-52. And behold, one of them which were with Jesus stretched out his hand and drew his sword and struck a servant of the high priests and smote off his ear. Then said Jesus unto him, put up again thy sword into his place, for all they that take the sword shall perish with the sword. So yeah, it's not a good idea to be living by violence. You live by violence, you'll die by violence. Interesting, in one of the other Gospels, Peter says, shall we smite with a sword? He just didn't really wait for an answer and just whack, takes the ear off. You may want to wait. When you pray, wait a little bit and see what the Lord says. You know, Lord, should I do this? And just plow on forward. You didn't answer me. Apparently, I just took your silence as consent. Don't do that with God. Not a good idea. Now, Babylon was judged for its imperialism. So this is probably the best part of the whole outline, I think, anyway. This is the crux of it. Look over in the book of Habakkuk. It's back there in the Old Testament. It's kind of hard to find. If you find it first, tell me where it's at. I just ended a sentence with a preposition like Pastor Boffy did today. Yeah, it's after Nahum, and it is before Zephaniah. I'm sure that's going to help everybody, because you all know right where Nahum is. Habakkuk 2:5-13. So I'm going to read the whole passage, and then I will go down through it and draw points out of it. Habakkuk 2:5-13. This is talking about Babylon, or the Chaldeans. It says, yea, also because he transgressed by wine, he is a proud man, neither keepeth at home, who enlargeth his desire as hell, and is as death, and cannot be satisfied, but gathereth unto him all nations, and heapeth unto him all people. Shall not all these take up a parable against him, and a taunting proverb against him, and say, woe to him that increaseth that which is not his. How long? You say, I thought you were reading about Babylon. This sounds like the United States of America. And to him that ladeth himself with thick clay, shall they not rise up suddenly that shall bite thee, and awake that shall vex thee, and thou shalt be for booties unto them? Because thou hast spoiled many nations, all the remnant of the people shall spoil thee, because of men's blood, and for the violence of the land, of the city, and of all that dwell therein. Woe to him that coveteth an evil covetousness to his house, that he may set his nest on high, that he may be delivered from the power of evil. Thou hast consulted shame to thy house by cutting off many people, and hast sinned against thy soul. For the stone shall cry out of the wall, and the beam out of the timber shall answer it. Woe to him that buildeth a town with blood, and establisheth a city by iniquity. Behold, it is not of the Lord of hosts that the people shall labor in the very fire, and the people shall weary themselves for very vanity. All right, so let's go through here and pull out a few points from this. First of all, just let me show you, he is speaking to Babylon, to the Chaldees. You go back to the first chapter, and verse 6 says, for lo, I raise up the Chaldeans, that bitter and hasty nation, which shall march through the breadth of the land to possess the dwelling places that are not theirs. So he's talking to Babylon here. Babylon, notice, in chapter 2, verse 5, is referred to as a man. It says, yea, also, because he transgresseth by wine, he is a proud man. He's called a proud man. See here what I'm saying? That nations are referred to as individuals, that nations are under the same rules as individuals are, dealing with themselves. Notice that Babylon didn't keep at home. Verse 5, neither keepeth at home. That reminds me of a verse over in Proverbs 27 and verse 20. Let me show you how he was breaking a law that's given to individuals. Proverbs 27 and verse 8. Did I say verse 20 before? If I did, I meant verse 8. Proverbs 27 and verse 8 says, as a bird that wandereth from her nest, so is a man that wandereth from his place. Let's just stay within our own borders. There's an idea. How about we bring the military home from the 130 countries where we are in, bring them home. Bring them to our own borders. There's an idea. Stay at home. Babylon couldn't be satisfied and had to continue conquering nations and people. They just couldn't ever be satisfied. It was never enough. It says there in verse 5, who enlargeth his desire as hell and is as death and cannot be satisfied, but gathereth unto him all nations and heapeth unto him all people. It's just never enough for people like this. We have to have absolute control over the whole globe. It's exactly how Babylon was. That's how all world empires are. And that's what causes them all to fall. They overextend themselves and they collapse under their own weight. You don't think it can happen? Just stick around for a few years. Let's see. That kind of reminds me of Proverbs 27 and verse 20. Look back there again. I hope you kept your finger there. You probably didn't. Proverbs 27 and verse 20 says, hell and destruction are never full, so the eyes of man are never satisfied. There's always more room in hell. It has an insatiable desire. So do men's eyes. Isn't that true? We're never satisfied. It's never enough. If I just had a little bigger house, if I just had a little more space, if I just had a newer car, if I just had more kids, you know, if I just had a wife, if I just had a better job, just a little more money, I'd be so much happier. I'd be content, just a little bit more. Give me 10 grand a year more, I'd be happy then, until you get 10 grand more. And then, well, I just need 10 more now, you know, they taxed me at a higher rate now, I wasn't expecting that, just 10 more, and then I'd be happy. Then I'd be good. Never satisfied. Babylon took what was not theirs. Look at Habakkuk 2 and verse 6. Shall not all these take up a parable against him and a taunting proverb against him and say, woe to him that increaseth that which is not his. How long? And to him that ladeth himself with thick clay. They took things that weren't theirs. That's called stealing. That's what that's called. Exodus 20 and verse 15 says, thou shalt not steal. Yeah, that's a principle that should apply to our government too. Thou shalt not steal from its own citizens and from the rest of the world for that matter. Ephesians 4:28 says, let him that stole steal no more. We're not supposed to steal. Babylon did violence to others. Look at verse 8, Habakkuk 2:8. It says, because thou hast spoiled many nations, all the remnant of the people shall spoil thee. You see, when you dig a pit, guess what happens? You fall into it. You spoiled others, you'll get spoiled. Well, they could never spoil us. We have the most powerful military in the world. Nobody can ever hurt the good old USA. That could never happen. That's what Babylon thought. That's what Egypt thought. That's what Assyria thought. That's what the Medes and the Persians thought. That's what the Greeks thought. That's what the Romans thought. All of them. They all think that nothing could ever happen to us. I am a queen and no other. Didn't Babylon say that? Yep. Nothing's ever going to happen to me. God says, oh yeah, you'll be desolate, left without children. They did violence to others. It says, because thou hast spoiled many nations, all the remnant of the people shall spoil thee. I'm reading the same verse again. Because of men's blood and for the violence of the land, of the city, and of all that dwell therein. We're not supposed to do violence to others. I already gave you a verse there in Luke 3:14. John the Baptist told the soldiers to do violence to no man. Any reasonable person understands this. You know, we know you don't just walk up to your neighbor and punch him in the face for no reason. But somehow, if it's one nation to another nation, it just seems okay and normal. They coveted. Look at verse 9, Habakkuk 2 and verse 9. It says, woe unto him that coveteth an evil covetousness to his house, and he that set his nest on high, that he may be delivered from the power of evil. Well, we're not supposed to covet. It says there in back in Exodus, thou shalt not covet. We all know that. It says the covetousness is idolatry in Colossians 3 and verse 5. That's a sin, in case you didn't know. That means trying, you know, desiring things that are not yours to have. Shouldn't do that. And lastly, they killed people, which was a sin. Murder is a sin. You know, you're not supposed to kill people that haven't harmed you. Real basic facts here. I mean, any child here could understand. Habakkuk 2, verse 10 says, "Thou hast consulted shame to thy house by cutting off many people." That's another way of saying killing them. "And thou hast sinned against thy soul." Mark 10, verse 19, Jesus quotes the law and says, "Thou shalt not kill," just in case you needed a verse for that. No government has the right to make its citizens kill other people who didn't attack them. The government has stepped over the line when it makes its citizens kill other people who have not attacked them. That is not godly government. Now, we are supposed to obey the government. I already read you Romans 13, most of it anyway. And there's other verses too. Turn to 1 Peter. We'll get that one. 1 Peter 2, 13 through 17. I'm not some kind of an anarchist saying that we shouldn't have any government. God institutes government. We should have government, and we should obey legitimate government. Even when you don't like their silly laws, if it's not ungodly, and if they're not forcing you to do something that God forbids, or not allowing you to do something that God requires, then you ought to obey the government. As much as I hate to say it, you should. That's what the Bible says. I don't like it. I'm a sinner like the rest of you. But that's what we should do. 1 Peter 2, 13 through 17. "Submit yourselves to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, whether it be to the king as supreme or unto governors as unto them that are sent by him for the punishment of evildoers or for the praise of them that do well. For so is the will of God, that with well-doing ye may put to silence the ignorance of foolish men, as free and not using your liberty as a cloak of maliciousness, but as the servants of God. Honor all men, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the king." But we are only obliged to obey as far as they are exercising their legal and legitimate authority. Pastor Boffy's taught you a lot of times, nobody on this earth has absolute authority. Jesus Christ is the only one that has all authority. He said, "All power is given unto me in heaven and in earth." He has all authority. No government has all and supreme authority. There are things that you can say no to and that you should say no to. Remember, there's more of us than there are of them. You know, if the parasite gets too big, it kills the host. It can't get too big, and they know that. There's more of us, and if people say no, then they have to back down. You know what? Refuse the draft. That's what I would do. If I was ever drafted again, no. I will not go. I will not be a cog in this machine that goes abroad and destroys other people that haven't attacked us. Just say no. It's just like Nancy Reagan's spiel on drugs. Just say no. Do the same to the government when they tell you to kill people. We must not obey when we have, when they have demanded that we do something that's forbidden by God. And I made reference to this, but turn to Acts 5 and verse 29. It may cost you. You know, ask people that didn't go whenever they were drafted in World War I. They get put in prison. World War II, Vietnam, all those wars. And of course, we're told that those people, oh, they're wimps, they're sissies, they're commies, you know, and they're demonized and everything. Here are poor people that just simply don't want to go murder people. We say, oh, those people, they're just a bunch of wimps. What's wrong with you? It's propaganda. Acts 5 and verse 29. Then Peter and the other apostles answered and said, "We ought to obey God rather than men." If it comes down to it, you obey God. God says, "Thou shalt not kill." The government says, "Thou shalt kill." Who are you going to obey? You obey God, not men. A government, therefore, cannot compel a person to kill another person. Look at Romans 13 and verse 9. This verse comes right after Paul is telling us to submit to the government, to the powers that be. In verse 9, he says, "For this, thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not bear false witness, thou shalt not covet. And if there be any other commandment, it is briefly comprehended in this saying, namely, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself." Goes back to what I was just talking about a minute ago. Treating other people as you would, you know, as they would treat you, as you would have them to treat you. So yeah, right after that, when Paul tells you to obey the government, he also tells you, don't kill. No Christian would kill his next door neighbor who did nothing to him if the government told him to do so. I mean, if I got a letter from Barack Obama or from anybody else in the government, and they say, all right, I want you to go down the hall and whack your next door neighbor. Say, go pound sand. No way. I'm not going to kill my next door neighbor. What's wrong with you? Everybody says, well, that's ridiculous. The government would never tell you to kill an innocent person. You don't think so? What do you think they do to our soldiers? What do you think they do? Therefore, as a Christian can and should resist any order by a government to kill a person in a different country who has not first attacked him. It doesn't really matter if there's a level of separation between the person giving the command and the person doing it. You shouldn't do it anyway. But I'll get it. What if you have, or what if you're put into that situation and you have no choice? I'll get into that in just a second. If your government has put you in such a position, either against your will or by lying to you and convincing you by propaganda, then they have the greater sin. They have the greater sin. Look at John 19 and verse 11. John 19 and verse 11. This is whenever the Jews delivered up Jesus to be killed by the Romans. And Jesus is speaking to Pilate here, and Jesus answered, said, thou couldest have no power at all against me, except it were given thee from above. Therefore he that delivered me unto thee hath the greater sin. The people that killed him didn't have as great of a sin as the people that delivered him up to be killed. The government that tells you, go over there and kill people, they have the greater sin. Now God has mercy on us when we do things in ignorance. Look at Acts 3 and verse 17. Look at Acts 3 and verse 17. Peter is speaking to these Jews who killed the Lord Jesus Christ, the only sinless man that ever lived. And he says, and now, brethren, I wot that through ignorance ye did it, as did also your rulers. There was mercy for those men. They killed the Prince of Peace. But Jesus saved some of them by his grace anyway. And they were repented of their sins and they were baptized. So if you were put in that position by your government, you were acting in self-defense to preserve your own life. So if your government sends you overseas on some kind of a war for U.S. interests or whatever, all the propaganda saving and delivering some poor people that are oppressed or whatever the lie is that they send you over there, and you end up getting in combat and in conflict, and you end up killing somebody, at that point, it's self-defense. You didn't ask to be there. You're there, and somebody's shooting at you. You have to shoot back. You're defending your own life. So at that point, it becomes self-defense. But the psychopaths and sociopaths that sent you over there to kill people for their own benefit, they have the greater sin. They are guilty of murder. And they ought to be strung up. They ought to be tried for war crimes. And they ought to be executed. Because they have the blood of millions of people on their hands. That's all I have to say about non-intervention. I hope this has been beneficial for you. Come to visit me in prison.